my name's John Clark, and I would like to welcome you to UCTV's four-part television series entitled Global Warming, Change Begins with Learning. This series is sponsored by the UCSB's Donald Brand School of Environmental Science and Management and the Community Environmental Council here in Santa Barbara. Funds are provided by the Global Warming Science and Societies series here at UCSB. We are having a number of episodes of this series. Others will be dealing with policy issues, resource productivity, and the link between climate change and water supply. But today we're talking ecology, and with that I'd like to welcome our two guests, Dr. Frank Davis and Dr. John Mielek. Thank you very much for coming.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Maybe we could begin by just allowing you guys to introduce yourself very briefly, talk about what you do at the Brand School and your broad area of research.
Yeah, I'm on the faculty at the Brand School. I teach landscape ecology and conservation planning, and my research is in that same area. I tend to study ecosystems of California over large areas, and I also look at land planning and nature reserve design.
Great. John?
Yeah, I'm an aquatic ecologist, which basically is a person who looks at what lives in and is influenced by water, lakes, rivers, coastal oceans. I've had the pleasure of doing this in most continents of the world. I've worked in Africa, South America, Asia, and North America. And it's a great opportunity in the Brent School to connect both with our local students and the world at large as we try to train a new generation of environmental science and managers and link those students and our own faculty research into the broader societal context of how we actually talk to corporate America, corporations worldwide, as well as public and private sector organizations, and try to make a difference.
And Professor Mielek, you're an associate dean at the school, I understand. Do I have that title right?
I am at this point, yes.
Okay. And how is the school as a whole trying to address climate change? Are you integrating that more in your program? Do you work with other departments? How does that work for your school?
It's a multifaceted effort, and one of the beauties of UCSB is that we have a great deal of collaboration across departments, across the university as a whole, and the Brent School is one element in this effort. We have a faculty that includes economists, some political scientists, natural scientists, and we have great colleagues in the natural sciences, the social sciences, and the humanities on this campus, and so the notion is to try to, in many dimensions as we can, to educate the community, hopefully the state, and even across the world, how one tries to look at these complicated issues from the point of view of multiple points of view.
Mm-hmm. Great. The other sponsor of this series is the Community Environmental Council. It's a nonprofit here in Santa Barbara, California. CEC has been around for a long time, relatively speaking, for environmental groups, about 30 years, and is now focusing on energy and climate change issues. CEC's main program right now is called Fossil Free by 33, and if people are interested in finding out more about that, the website is cecsb.org. But let's turn things over to the focus of the conversation today. You are both well-known researchers in your field, and maybe we could start talking about the research you're doing and what you're seeing, particularly as it relates to climate change, and we'll leave that open to whoever wants to start. What are you seeing out there?
Frank?
Well, my research is on ecological processes like fire and fire hazard in California, plant distributions, why plants are where they are, and how that responds to climate. We have just one project that's specifically looking at climate change scenarios in the western U.S. and trying to understand how the climate change that's projected would translate into biological change. And I guess the short answer is, even under fairly moderate scenarios of climate change, it's very biologically disruptive, and species distributions will have to change quite a bit to keep up with it.
And what kind of changes could we, can you tell us more about what those changes might be, make that real for the lay people of us? What might we see over the course of 30, 50, 40 years if we go walking around? What's going to be different?
In a nutshell, we will see fewer species, and we will see new species in our areas, and we will probably see species doing things differently than they used to in terms of the timing of events like flowering or hatching and so forth. In this part of the world, we tend to think of warming as driving species uphill and towards the poles. Mm-hmm. And the question is really how far they would have to move uphill or northward in order to keep up with the climate change. And that's a real challenge in places that are developed like California, where you have a lot of fragmentation, a lot of agriculture and urbanization.
What happens if, for a plant species or an animal species, they hit L.A.?
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of hard to migrate unless you know how to drive on the 405. So what happens to those species? What are the impacts of that?
You really only have three choices as a species. You can either tolerate the change, and some species have a broad enough range of tolerance that they can adapt physically. You can try to evolve and adapt genetically, mm-hmm. and there's some amount of that can go on, or you have to move. And if climate's changing really rapidly, in general, you have to move or tolerate. And if you can't move, then you go extinct. And we've seen some of that already. Particularly the species that are really vulnerable now in temperate latitudes would be mountaintop species that are already pinned up in the coolest elevations they can mm-hmm. find. So in that case, where species are literally trapped in place, we're starting to see these pretty serious population extinctions.
So I know there's an area in the southwestern United States, ecologically, I've heard it referred to as the Sky Islands, where the cooler climates, where there's, megafauna, jaguars and whatnot, literally are on islands surrounded by deserts. So you're saying that those species and those ecosystems are going to be seriously impacted, potentially?
Yeah, I think you could probably say a lot of habitat species live in are island-like. They're isolates of one kind or another. Some of them are literally islands in the ocean. Some are islands at the tops of mountain ranges. Some are islands in a sea of humanity, mm-hmm. increasingly, and natural habitats left in agricultural landscapes and so forth. Those species will have the hardest time coping with climate change, and particularly those that just don't move that readily. Some species can fly, some can't, some are more mobile than others.
So make that real for me. What kind of species, we'll take the California context since we're here, what kind of species can we see that you think we're going to see some specific impact? What are we not going to have? Is it mountain lions? Is it coyotes? Is it, the little mice? What species are likely to go away?
Well, the bigger, more mobile animals have other problems as well mm-hmm. to deal with. And this is one of the messages that we need to convey is that climate change, its impact in part depends on other human activities as well, such as habitat fragmentation, pollution, and so forth. But the species that we've already seen showing a lot of sensitivity would be, I'll give you an example of this little animal called the pika, mm-hmm. which lives in the mountaintops of the western U.S., and it occurs only above tree line and cold, snowy areas, and it depends on it being able to hibernate and waking up and finding a certain amount of food and being able to store a certain amount of food during the winter. Already, because of climate warming, that species has declined pretty precipitously across its mountaintop environments. It doesn't have anywhere to go, and it can't keep up with, in terms of evolution, the rate of climate change.
And what about plants? The sentinel species of the big species mm-hmm. here in this area, oaks, different kinds of oaks. Are there any sort of, I know there's megafauna, I don't know if there's mega plants, but things that we would notice that on the landscape over time that it's going to look different to us?
I think all, the vegetation you see in part reflects the climate. If you change the climate even a little bit, you will see changes in the vegetation. And we've already seen that around the world, where people have been able to actually look at the records. Species are moving mm-hmm. towards the poles. They're moving up in elevation. Plants are flowering several weeks earlier now than they did in the early 20th century. So some species will be more sensitive than others. The long-lived species tend to be the slowest to change. Mm-hmm. The giant sequoias that are so famous in California, they mm-hmm. live so long that the ones that are already established can tolerate a fair amount of climate change. The ones that tend to turn over faster, the shorter-lived species, are the ones we'll probably see the most rapid effects of climate change on.
And that, of course, will have impact to the animals that are based on that ecosystem, too, I imagine. It can be very space-specific for creatures.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really important for people to understand about climate change is that it affects each species somewhat individualistically. Every species has its own way of moving and dispersing. It has its own timing of life history, or when it flowers, when it hatches out of eggs, and so forth. And when you apply climate change across a whole set of species, species that depend on one another can come uncoupled. Mm-hmm. The butterfly hatches out expecting to find a flower in bloom that can provide it nectar, and the flowers already bloomed 3 weeks earlier. Mm-hmm. So this kind of uncoupling means that the systems of plants and animals across the landscape are very vulnerable to disruption.
And do you, as scientists, have a sense of how that might unravel? Of, you know, this plant blooms early, this butterfly misses it, this bird that ate that butterfly misses that. I mean, is there a sense of how that may cascade out, or are we just figuring it out as we see it?
Well, I think we're seeing some changes now that are predictable. One of the, I think, obvious lessons is that this is a pretty strong filter. Some species will fare better than others. Hmm. In general, the species that are more generalist, can handle a wide range of conditions, they're well dispersed. Weedy species mm-hmm. tend to be promoted by this. The other thing that we've learned is be ready for surprise. Mm-hmm. We've already seen surprises in the way that climate change might affect a disease that affects an amphibian, and that mm-hmm. combination of warming plus the disease vector can exterminate things like wow. high elevation frogs in the Central America. I mean, these mm-hmm. are, so it's a combination of things we could have predicted as well as things that are just going to be continually surprising us.
And John, what about the aquatic world? I mean, that's where your specialty is. What kinds of things are you seeing?
Let me sort of step back for a minute and respond to a couple of good points that Frank made. He's sort of getting involved with the generic issue of the multiple range of species and how they interact with each other. And we tend sometimes to focus on iconic species, which is okay up to a point. But mm-hmm. the fabric of the ecosystem really depends on the diversity of organisms there. And as we look more and more at these kind of interactions among the species, we realize that converting a rich, diverse system into one with weeds or generalists not only is not so interesting aesthetically, but actually may have very serious impacts on human use of those natural ecosystems. And I'll give you one example.
That's
of that.
Right, exactly where I was heading.
You know, if you know, we talk now. This is going to be a little bit of a segue into solutions to climate change in a biological context. So we've heard a lot about biomass as a way to generate energy in a more carbon neutral way. If we do that through growing monocultures, which is one of our standard agricultural practices, we invest a lot of energy in the monoculture maintenance and cultivation and so forth. And recent studies are showing us that native grasslands are actually as productive, sequester more carbon because their root structure is more complicated, and take less input of energy. So the very diversity of the in this case, a grassland community, works both ecologically better. It also provides us as a human society with a better way to sequester some of the carbon that we're pumping into the atmosphere. Hmm. So here's a link between ecosystem and plant diversity and our own carbon sequestration question.
That doesn't sound like a very good cycle. That sounds one of those self-defeating cycles too. Is it less biodiversity means less response to climate change in that case?
Exactly. Hmm. Now, in terms of aquatic systems, in addition to the warming that we talk about, as we warm the climate, we also change rainfall patterns. Patterns being where it rains and how much it rains. And as you do that, you clearly affect whether a stream is in flood or in drought conditions. Here in Santa Barbara, we're used to variability. Mm-hmm. The particular climate we're exposed to is one that's very prone to be variable. But as you look around the world, some climates are much less that way. And I work some in the Amazon Basin. And the Amazon Basin tends to be wet most of the time, less wet, more wet. But as you start changing rainfall patterns in a place like that, and even our eastern coast is similar to that, a six-week period with no rain in Virginia is a pretty serious drought for most of the organisms there. In California, of course, we're adapted to those kinds of conditions. So what we see in aquatic environments, especially in streams and rivers, is that the organism's ability to move and to even survive is clearly dependent on there being water in the stream bed. And those are the kind of organisms that are highly sensitive to changing precipitation patterns. The other dimension is relating to rainfall and in California's snow, in fact, is that we depend a lot on snow as our water supply, and one of the later episodes of this will deal with that in detail. But from an ecological point of view, what we find is that the duration of the snowpack has a large impact on the chemicals that are released from the soils and from the snow. And as we modify the amount of snow, we change how much nitrogen leaves these ecosystems, which in turn affects the ability of the plants and animals to adapt to these changing conditions. So what we're really trying to say here is that we can worry about, and we should, about individual species, but we also have to worry about the constellation of multiple species. We also have to look at the functions that are being served in terms of whether carbon is being kept in the soil or released, whether nitrogen is being kept in the soil or released. And it's this constellation of interactions that makes the problem hard, but concern.
Well, we'll talk about some of those system impacts. I guess we've talked a little bit about species, and you know, our society is, in this country, we've invested so much in the Endangered Species Act trying to prop up some of these species. And what does this mean? I mean, how do you preserve a polar bear when the top half of its habitat is melting and the bottom half is, and that boundary is moving? What do you do? Or the grizzly bear that's, you know, in the Rockies that needs this bark off the, you know, the seed from this particular tree that's changing. What does one do to preserve those species? Where do all these programs go? And then secondarily, have we even, from a management perspective, begun to adapt to what's clearly going to be a new regime? So how do we do that?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that when they drafted the Endangered Species Act 30 years ago, they didn't have climate change in mind because it is so pervasive. And, you know, we've had extinctions in the past. We can look back over the last couple of million years of ice ages and the warm periods between the ice ages, and we've seen when climate changes rapidly, lots of species can go extinct in a hurry because they can't keep up with the change. And the rates of change that are forecast for the 21st century are of that order of magnitude or greater. We've seen lots of changes even in the 20th century with relatively moderate rates of climate change. Multiply that by a factor of 5 to 10 over the next 100 years, and I think it's going to be very challenging to try to protect species with our 20th century strategies. You mentioned polar bears. It's a perfectly good example. Very remote in the quote-unquote wild part of the world, and yet that species is declining fairly precipitously now because of the decline in sea ice. The strategies that we've used include things like habitat conservation for species as they become rare. It would take a lot of land to solve that problem under climate change. Small reserves simply don't suffice to protect endangered species anymore.
Well, let's talk about that because so much of our ecological protection is based on national parks and national wildernesses, and then you have the sort of conservation biology Y2Y thing where it's trying to create a core of habitat areas so that species and gene pools can move. I mean, I look at some of those maps, they're huge, you know, and some say, oh, you know, want everyone to move out of Denver so that the animals can walk through. But talk more about that for folks. What does that mean? How do you interconnect those things, and how big is big if we're talking about conserving some of these species?
Not big enough. I'll just say that as we learn more and more about the area requirements of species, particularly some of the bigger species, the wide-ranging, you mentioned some carnivores like mountain lions and so forth, you cannot build reserve systems big enough to keep these species alive under climate change, is sort of the bottom line. Instead, it seems you have to develop land use systems that include reserves, where you really focus on managing for those species. But then you've also got to design agricultural systems, rural residential systems and so forth that can accommodate more of these species as they redistribute themselves around the planet. There are a lot of other things that we do that make it hard on species too.
Well, we haven't been very good at either of those last two things.
Right. So I think, you know, this poses some real challenges. It means that the scale of our conservation and management activities has to be rethought to a much, much larger scale. And it has to involve a lot of elements of our lifestyle besides simply setting aside bits of land and bits of water and hoping the species can persist in those little bits.
Well, it seems, particularly in the western United States, that we're actually moving the exact opposite way, where, you know, ex-Californians or ex-urbanites are moving more into the Rocky Mountain front and taking urban expectations in terms of carnivores, that Fifi doesn't get eaten off the porch by a bear or a wolf, and we're interfering more as opposed to less. So it's beyond ecology. It's back to urban planning and economics and a whole. It's kind of a big thing.
But to be
point.
To be a little more
optimistic,
hopeful on,
that's
on this.
Nice. Thank you.
I mean, in California specifically, there are some large land holdings in the state which are in private hands, and I guess from what I'm seeing is quite a lot of enlightened landowners looking at their properties and realizing that if they can think of ways to make a living, which is a fair thing to want to do, but to keep the land intact in large extent and allow the kind of things Frank's talking about, to have a more compatible interaction between the landowners and the wildlife. Let me give you an example from Brazil. In the central part of Brazil, there's a very large wetland, which is I like the Everglades. It's called the Pantanal, but it's been occupied for over two centuries by cattle ranchers. And these so-called fazendas or ranchers are large. They're hundreds of square kilometers in area. And they have a very rich wildlife there, jaguars and many other beautiful organisms. And many of the ranchers there are taking the position, look, we can sacrifice, in quotes, a subset of our cattle to maintain this diverse, including top predator environment. And it's not going to impact us significantly. And to me, this is a good example of people sometimes think that everything, the rainforests are being cut down in parts of Brazil. But in fact, this is a long-standing, compatible relation between land use, stewardship, and the coexistence of multiple species. And I think it takes a lot of land to do this, for sure, but we have national parks. California actually has an amazing amount of open space, really. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's on military reserves, and the military is actually trying to do better at managing these reserves, too, in various ways. So I think we have to, I'm going to be at least hopefully a hopeful person, and I think we have some options here that we can try to promote.
So how do you set that up? I mean, you know, shoot, shovel, and shut up is a bumper sticker in a lot of places, and so you're talking about an economic change, a cultural change, and I agree, there's in between the various publicly held land, there's lots of private land, and you know, the ability to walk across if you're a bear or mountain lion is, you want that. How do you change that culture? How did that situation get created? How do you make it so that people are comfortable with, since we're talking about climate change adaptation all of a sudden, that people are comfortable with that change?
Well, quickly, I'll say one thing, and you jump in, Frank. Some of the organizations, I mean, if you look at the fishing community, the inland fishing community, and the bird hunting community, you know, the Ducks Unlimited is an organization that's fundamentally interested in a sport, but they have invested immense amounts of energy and resources in preserving wetlands for... And managing the wildlife in a way that is basically sustainable. So I think that the cultural change you're talking about isn't that far away, and there's many good examples of people realizing that you can manage a resource and humans can benefit as well as the organisms.
But those examples typically are based on some form of take. I mean, at the end of the day, the goal is a dead duck. And you know, we're talking about grizzlies and wolves and other species where, at least right now, at least from the environmental side, take is just not part of the conversation. So how does that fit in?
Well, you're picking some of the hardest species to work with.
Well, okay.
But let's take the general principle, which is that under rapidly changing climate, with all sorts of other pollution concerns, reserves alone don't tend to protect enough species. They simply can't do it. Even large parks, we've learned that from recent studies, even with big Canadian parks that are still losing species. John's right. You know, you then look outside the reserves to a more sustainable management of the rural landscape, whether it's managed for grazing or for timber production or for wildlife for hunting and so forth. And it turns out many species are quite compatible with those kinds of uses if you manage appropriately. It may take management incentives. Mm-hmm. Instead of buying land, perhaps we're trying to create incentives for landowners, wherever that be in the world, to actually change their management practices just a little bit to accommodate these different species. And I think they're good examples of that. I think the Nature Conservancy has done a lot of work in this area, for example, over the last 20 years, both in the U.S. and now abroad as well. And they have good examples where you can, with small changes in management goals, accommodate a lot more wild nature outside of nature reserves.
So this is a big change for the environmental movement. I mean, culturally speaking, as a movement, our job has been to slam ranchers, stop mining, and it's a different relationship when you're talking about a new conversation that, and somehow we have to get everyone to want to have that. Is that true, and how do you see that evolving, and do you see places where it is happening?
Well, let me put a little plug in for the Brin School, because we basically were founded on the principle of trying to establish these dialogues, and not to tar and feather somebody because of what they might have done 50 years ago, but to say that the landscape of the world is one that involves a variety of different players, and you need to have a conversation with the full spectrum of players. Let me mention one other thing about that we need to obviously emphasize is the value of education. And the University of California has a unique set of what are called natural reserves, and we have 35 of these scattered around the state representing many habitats. Now, they're relatively small. Some are larger than others, but they're relatively small. But what they provide us with is a way not only to do research, but also to teach, and not just teach at the university level, but teach at the community level. And so an example of that is on the eastern side of the Sierra, we have a reserve near Mammoth Lakes, and we have over 2,000 students from the local community up and down the whole eastern side of the Sierra that come to these reserves and learn about a variety of aspects of natural history, and issues like global warming come up. Now, some of this is a resource-based area, tourism-based, but both resource-based. Some of the parents think that we're teaching their kids to be, kind of opposed to, some extractive industries. Mm-hmm. What we hope is that it'll be a balanced discussion, that the students will learn certain things, the children will learn certain approaches, and they'll ask their parents provocative questions, and there'll be a transition. But I think we can't lose sight of the extreme importance of education in the positive sense of the word, of sharing information and learning about each other's points of view. Can I add something to that?
Yeah, I think this is true. The a lot of times it really is just understanding or awareness of a problem. I'll say in terms of climate change and conservation of nature, a lot of times operating in a way that benefits nature does actually make sense in terms of minimizing the impact of climate change. That is, for example, minimizing the footprint of development makes it easier for species to move around and reassemble. Mm-hmm. It's also, in general, economically, a much smarter thing for us to do, and we call it smart growth for a reason. Mm-hmm. Conserving water makes sense anyway, but it certainly reduces your vulnerability to climate change, to reduce your water consumption. That also makes it a lot easier on aquatic biodiversity. So there are a number of these things where you could sort of argue, knowing climate change is coming at us, we're in it and it's accelerating. Things that we will try to do to take care of ourselves will probably also benefit many wild species at the same time.
But you may not want to touch this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. There'll be a couple of those. One of the management tools that you hear talked about in terms of opening the landscape to human use and wildlife is tourism, particularly ecotourism. And it seems like it's a double-edged sword. But I'm not sure. You tell me, in terms of what you've seen out there, is this part of the management tool? Is this something we should be looking for more of? Or is it a bad idea to be shipping tourists to the middle of the Amazon rainforest in hope of keeping it going, because pretty soon they're going to have a lodge and four-wheel drive and a golf course and all that stuff? So what's the role of tourism in this? Is it plus or minus?
My feeling is it's a net positive. Getting people into the Amazon, I think, is fine. I mean, the ecotourism industry there is tiny. In this country, maybe it's a little different. I mean, we have wonderful national parks and state parks and so forth. When we start talking about building, major tourist resort communities, then it's a little more of a trade-off. But on the other hand, if the people can't stay in a hotel, they can't access the park very well. So mm-hmm. I think it's more a matter of how you manage things. You know, it's one thing when we first, if you look at the history of, for example, Sequoia National Park, you know they were cutting holes in trees, letting people drive their cars through them, and they built the lodges up in the right in the middle of the giant forest, the Sequoia Forest. Now they've tried to move those facilities into a more ecologically benign place. The people can still access it just as well. So I think a lot of these solutions are relatively straightforward, mm-hmm. with a little bit of forward planning.
Yeah, you know, I think if you look at the trends in where people live, 4 out of 5 people live in cities.
Mm-hmm.
And the cities, the world is getting more and more urban.
Mm-hmm.
And it raises a couple of issues. One, it means that people will have less and less direct contact with wildlands and with nature, quote unquote, in their daily lives. You will need to somehow satisfy that need. The question of whether you can't move a lot of people to remote wild places to see exotic animals. That will be good for some rural economies, and it will be good for the wealthy few. I think another issue, though, is actually how you provide some access to nature, mm-hmm. right in the periphery of cities. And part of that is, again, creating kind of green infrastructure, as it's called, spaces in the city, spaces around the city, and rethinking the rural landscapes around our urban areas, and maybe managing them more for what sometimes people call new ruralism, which is literally letting people come out from the city and experience what a farm actually is, what a ranch is, what wild species look like, and so forth. And there's probably benefit there to local economies, but also to our conservation goals as well, and a little bit more, perhaps, spread of the wealth that way.
I was involved in some things on the Gaviota Coast here as being sort of our next to closest coastal ecological preserve-ish thing, and there was a discussion between environmentalists, ranchers, and then public representatives, and there just was this incredible tension between the public representatives clearly wanting more parks, the ranchers wanting people to not mess up their land because they've had, based on experience, and the ecologists looking for ecological space, and it was a real balance in there, and between those three interests, it was hard to find that perfect balance point where everyone would say, okay, that's worthwhile, because in many cases, what you talked about, that access, is just the antithesis of a rancher who is out there in part because he's really glad there aren't a bunch of people around him. So it seems like it's going to be an interesting balance and a culture change for all of us.
Agreed.
That kind of
thing. I think there is a culture change underway. And some ranchers are actually finding it's a way to keep ranching,
mm-hmm.
is to actually have weekend guests.
Right. I've heard of that, particularly in the southern United States, that more and more ranchers are opening to that kind of tourism because you can't make a living on cows, from what I understand.
So I think it can be to the benefit of the rural economy, and it can also relieve some of our needs for just getting people in the cities out into the country.
Mm-hmm.
But I do agree with you. This is an area of environmental planning and kind of social change that's underway now that is very important in the long run.
So are you addressing this at the Bren School? I mean, you now need a number of environmentally oriented B&B owner rancher types that you need to put out there. Is it part of your curriculum? Is it the kind of thing you're going to be looking at to teach people?
And one of the aspects of our curriculum is we have a professional master's degree, which is sort of analogous to an MBA. It's a 2-year program, and as part of that, the students do a project in groups of say 4 to 5, and these projects cover a wide range of topics, but almost every year several deal with exactly the issue you're raising. They deal with how to work with landowners in various land management questions. So I'll give you one example, which is local to the Santa Barbara area. It's part of this beautiful western so-called Gaviota Coast. The Santa Barbara Land Trust purchased a property mm-hmm. called the Royal Hondo, and as part of one of these group projects, we did a management plan for them. We looked at all the dimensions, what kind of recreational uses could be compatible, what kind of restoration was needed, because even though this land was fairly had been fallow for a while, there still were lots of introduced species there, and so this is one example. Now Frank has also supervised a number of these projects where the students get their hands dirty. They work with the, as you pointed out correctly, the diverging values and interests, and the notion is to combine science, economics, and policy and try to show our students, but also provide our clients with some at least a potential set of solutions. So this is, I would say, central to what we do, and we deal with exactly that kind of issue regularly. and welcome them. They're challenging, but they're important.
Are you seeing young people come into the program that are looking for that kind of diverse experience, that are seeing environmentalism differently, or are you, is it the same as it was 15, 20 years ago when students coming in?
I think it's quite different. I mean, I think it's certainly the students that we see are, they're coming from, most of them have graduated, worked in a whole variety of capacities, have come coming back to school, and they want to make a difference. They want to find solutions, and they know that those solutions are only done if you work with an investment bank, or if you work with an enlightened NGO, or if you work with a federal agency. You have to get in there and really work with the people that are making the decisions. And our students are fully engaged in this way of facing issues.
Do you agree with that? Just wanted to see if we can get a second.
Yeah, I think the answers to environmental problems have never been simple, mm-hmm. but they've never been more complicated than they are now. Mm-hmm. And I think our students come in with a lot of courage to even take on some of these problems, and what they get from us is probably more dimensions of the problem. So they might come in really focused on reserves for endangered species, but then they learn about how corporations work and how laws operate across society, and the way you manage water and you manage ecosystems. And when you put all that together, they're capable, they're more empowered to actually take on some of these complex problems. And I really do think the climate change problem is one that's going to test everybody because mm-hmm. of the scale and the way it affects so many different aspects of our society and our daily life. And when you get into policies, you mentioned the Endangered Species Act, these are policies that are set up that affect the way we behave now, but they weren't designed for the kinds of changes we're looking at in the future. And there are a number of things like this, the way we currently govern land use policy, water use policy, nature conservation, and so forth. So I'm just glad they're all as inspired and enthusiastic as they are, because it's a very complex set of issues to deal with.
Well, let's touch on policy for just a little bit. If you were in the room with, pick the politician or legislator of your choice, and you were going to kind of go over the list of, all right, you've told this story, the world has changed, the policy toolkit that you had before is outlived its time, here's some things that you need to do. Here's a beginning of a policy menu for a policymaker. What kinds of things would you say? What would you pass along?
I've been in this business long enough to not answer as a policymaker, given that I'm a scientist.
But you're speaking to a policymaker. You're telling a policymaker what they may want to say.
So let me just, a couple things immediately that I would emphasize. One is, I think, the magnitude of the challenge. I'm still not sure if people understand that the mm-hmm. policymakers, I think some of our leaders are beginning to get it. Mm-hmm. And they're beginning to actually respond with strong legislation to try to reduce carbon emissions and to try to adapt. I think the overriding message is, though, it's happening fast. The changes are likely to be pretty dramatic, and we should do both mitigation and adaptation. Mm. Think about what it means that sea level is rising as fast as it is if you're a coastal state. Think about it if you're so dependent on snowmelt for your water supply, what climate change actually means, and build in some resilience to your water management system. These are the kinds of advice I would give. Think big. And be ready for some surprises.
Yeah, I think the urgency of the issue sounds like a bit of hyperbole, perhaps. And in fact, as we watch the weather, it's freezing. We have a frost in a week ago in this part of the world, and it's very warm in Minnesota. And we can sort of say, well, what's the big deal? I mean, weather changes, and so in one sense, you need to have a long time frame of records to see the general trends. But by the same token, as Frank's been emphasizing, the evidence is getting stronger and stronger that things are actually changing, and they're changing at a slightly faster rate. And so the decision maker, of course, has a constituency which has a time frame of interest, as their own elected office does. And that's one of the biggest challenges. In one sense, not to make it seem too urgent, so that we're basically predicting things that aren't happening, but by the same token, unless you start to act relatively soon, the impacts of waiting become more dangerous. Mm-hmm. A planned approach, if you plan ahead, you buy insurance, you clear the land around your house, have a fire, you're protected, your chance of having your house affected is less. If you don't do either of those, then you're in a bad shape. And I think what we're hoping is that we'll see a greater sense of reality, that these are things that are happening, and economically, there are many options to make win-win situations, mm-hmm. as one of the other sectors of this program will talk about, you know, the use of new engineering and recycling and remanufacturing approaches, energy efficiency in general. So my message would be, don't panic, but let's make a plan and let's roll up our sleeves and engage, and there'll be many winners and fewer losers.
This is an important point. I mean, don't panic. There are win-win situations out mm-hmm. there. In general, a good climate strategy tends to also often be a good economic strategy. It also mm-hmm. tends to be a good social policy for other reasons as well. And I think it's important that people understand that.
Well, one of the, this is also going to put you on the spot, but that's okay. One of the other issues that I grew up in was recycling with the Community Environmental Council. And CEC worked for years, kind of the voice in the wilderness, trying to move the idea forward, and then there was the Islip barge back east, which somehow got into people's head, and this fairly, actually, when it comes down to it, non-important event became really important and changed people's mind, and recycling really changed a lot after that. Mm-hmm. What would be the kind of catalytic events that you guys could imagine from an ecological perspective that might be so emblematic that people go, oh, God, it is real. We need to do something. Can you even start to picture how? I don't want to lead into it by saying how bad it would be. But what are the kinds of things that you think would get people's attention and push this change forward? Any ideas?
Let me start by saying, again, I'm going to speak strictly as somebody who looks at wild species. So we're going to talk about plants and animals.
That's good.
First.
That's why we're here.
If you look at the signal over the 20th century, it's relatively subtle. Animals and plants are responding to climate change. They are changing their distributions. They are flowering earlier in the mm-hmm. spring. Birds are migrating at different times and so forth. But unless you're a biologist, it's a relatively subtle signal. Okay? And I think, as John said, we need to kind of get ahead of this a little bit, and the signals are going to become more and more dramatic, but you need action before we get to some catastrophe or some kind of a disaster biologically. So to me, the most important event is not an ecological event, it's a political event when political leaders actually decide to do something about it.
So how do you get to their constituents to get to the politicians to get to this? I mean, how do you motivate a lot of people to all of a sudden think it's a big deal? Which I hope we're moving in that direction, but I'm not sure. So what do you do with that?
Let's step back historically for a moment, since we're about at the 50-year anniversary of this. Environmental movement, if you will, you know, while people attribute a lot of it to Santa Barbara's oil spill, the publication of Silent Spring mm-hmm. in, I think it was 1957, is viewed by many people's minds as a watershed in public awareness. And why was that? I mean, what was so special about that? It was... The title helped, you know. The mm-hmm. the author was an appropriate kind of person. It had a relatively simple message, but one that was provocative. I'm going to answer your question a little parochially first, then we can be more general. So here at Santa Barbara, and you see the University of California, Santa Barbara, and the town of Santa Barbara, we now have a book, if you will, the whole mm-hmm. community is. And the book that we're reading this year is one related to global warming, and it's a book that was written by Elizabeth Colbert, and it deals with global warming issues. And I think one way that you do effect change is by having an enlightened and educated population who can read a document which is not strident but is balanced and makes a case and resonates with enough people. So instead of the messenger being a person running for office with some vested interest, but a more neutral person who can actually affect a social awareness, I think mm-hmm. that's what you're really raising. I mean, what raises people's awareness? It can be a catastrophic event. And unfortunately, I think one thing that is that, to some extent, is the hurricanes that affected New Orleans. I mean, although the link between those hurricanes and global warming is tenuous, I wouldn't argue that there's a direct link by any means. But the mere fact that the city has subsided, it's below sea level, makes it much more vulnerable. And so as sea level will continue to rise, inevitably, that kind of situation will increase. The intensity of storms will increase, whether they be hurricanes or other kinds of storms. So there's, I guess, an accumulation of events such as that, plus well-done television shows, books, education at all levels, from children through adults. So I think there, I'm not looking for a silver bullet, but I think there's a number of at least copper bullets.
A slow, steady drip of information.
Exactly.
Okay.
With a few punctuated by hopefully not too many really bad tragedies, but at least enough both positive and somewhat frightening events. I think we need both. We can't have just frightening events. We need positive events as well.
You did talk about marine issues just briefly there, and I was wondering if one of you could go, even though it's may not be your absolute specialty of field, but what can we expect in the marine environment? What kinds of things are happening in the ocean? And I hear there's some other, there's a very long word here that someone wrote down, but you know what I'm talking about. Talk about that.
Okay.
First start with a really long word, that name I can't remember.
Well, I'll get there in a second. But let me respond to in a sense, the kind of event that gets people's attention. One of the reasons people go to tropical islands is, besides the lie in the sun, is to look at coral reefs. And they're fantastically diverse ecosystems and beautiful to watch, even if you're not studying the organisms there, just scuba diving or snorkeling. And as oceans have warmed, we find that corals, the term is bleach, they lose the algae they're living with the animal, and they become white. And they can't survive under those conditions, because coral need a plant living in the animal, and the combination makes the living organism, which then lays down the skeleton, which becomes the coral skeleton. So there's a direct link between global warming and these whiting events affecting corals all over the world. The long word you're talking about is what people refer to as ocean acidification.
Yeah.
Now, people have heard
I set you up to have to say that.
People have heard of acidification in the context of acid rain. That term has been now around for about 20 years. The oceans, of course, are salty, and they have chemicals in them that keep them from changing a lot in the chemical composition. But as you keep putting more and more CO2 into the atmosphere, where does most of that CO2 go? It goes into the ocean. And in the long term, that's where it's going to end up. And as you add more and more CO2, CO2 is an acid when you dissolve it in water. And so it actually changes the chemical composition of the ocean in a way that makes it more difficult for corals to even make their skeleton. So in addition to the warming influence of the temperature changing the amount of plants living with the animals, the actual ability of the coral to make its coral skeleton, if you will, is changed because of the acidification caused by the long-term input of CO2 into the ocean. It also affects other organisms that are small, tiny, microscopic plants and some larger animals that float in the ocean as a whole. And so there's over a multi-decadal time frame, there's a very serious concern that as the ocean chemistry changes, there are profound changes to the organisms that are present there. We could spend a couple days talking about the details of the chemistry, but we won't do that here.
Have a fifth episode in the
series. Exactly, right.
Well, I mean, the stories and the data that you guys are presenting and are talking about are obviously terrifying and eye-catching, and at this day and age still, there are a number of climate change skeptics. People just say, this isn't happening. And when I read congressional reports or listen to the media, the complaints seem to fall into three categories. One is, you know, the data people are talking about is just not true. In fact, there's research saying, well, polar bears are doing great. I don't know what they're talking about. And then the other level of argument is, well, there are a few data points, but you can't really add that up to be saying this is climate change. And then the last is, you know, this isn't science anymore. This has become a political thing, and the scientific debate has been hijacked by foundations. And as scientists, Can you respond to, you know, those things? You could start at the beginning or start wherever you want, but how do you address that? And how do we as lay people listen to that argument and that discussion and ferret out our beliefs and the truth?
You start?
Well, I think you can say that the debate has shifted in its tone a little bit over the last 10 years. So I think because the evidence is now building to make the case that we are undergoing climate change. I don't think anybody argues with the fact that the world has gotten warmer over the last 100 years, and it's gotten warmer at a fairly unprecedented rate, at least in terms of recent history. And I think most people would now agree that it's associated with greenhouse gases that are trapping heat in our atmosphere. And I think most people would also agree that that's due to, in large part, human activities like burning fossil fuels and clearing forests. So
the hockey stick that Al Gore had in his movie, is that
debate,
a real thing?
Or? No, the debate is shifting.
Uh-huh.
So more and more people, I think, are understanding that it is real. I think where you run into the uncertainties and where it's very hard to be in a position of political leadership is what to do about it. And that depends on what your scenarios for the future are. How is this system going to continue to change? A little bit of warming we could probably all cope with, adapt to, and suffer some minor disruptions.
Mm-hmm.
Warming at the rate that's projected under some of these, with some of the models for some of the carbon scenarios, is something that's going to require a lot of fairly bold action. The problem I see is, and the reason people still like to argue about it, is because whatever you do now, and this comes back to something John said earlier, it's going to be hard to see a change in the climate system, perhaps for decades, to mm-hmm. decisions you make now because of this enormous inertia in the climate system. The ocean tends to have a long memory, for example. And we can make some pretty dramatic changes now, decisions that will help us in the long run, but we may not be able to see the full implications of those decisions for quite a while in terms of the change in the climate system. So my sense, just to repeat what I said, I think there's less uncertainty and there's less political and scientific debate now than there was even 5 or 10 years ago. I think the question is what to do about it, and there's a lot of divergence of opinion among political leaders.
Well, although you do have the former head of the Natural Resources Committee saying that this is the greatest hoax perpetuated on the American people since I don't remember what was before it. I mean, so there is, that's a very basic level debate. It's not even how to deal with it, but that it exists. It's amazing.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, if you quote almost anyone out of context, it's hard to know completely where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know that quote has been used a lot, but I wasn't there. I don't know exactly why it was said the way it was. But I mean, but maybe put a little different spin on this. I mean, one of the characteristic features of science as a way of trying to understand the world is that we know we don't know all the answers, and as a result, we constantly ask each other questions, and so it's healthy. It's important, and even a fairly strong statement like you just quoted has the benefit of at least pushing people to say, okay, guys, if this is really as bad as you say, and we have to do these really dramatic things to change our way of living, our basic society, mm-hmm. you better be really sure that you got it right. And so it's a big responsibility. And you know, you can be a scientist and do very good science and never have to face some of these implications of what you're proposing about the way the world's working. And so I think when this issue became more and more clear that it really seemed to be a global scale societal problem, the scientists had to step back, take a deep breath, and say, are we really as sure as we think we are? Because this isn't just a paper in some journal. This actually affects the mm-hmm. lives of millions of people. So I think I totally agree with Frank that the consensus, you know, is very solidly now behind the notion of the climate is changing, greenhouse gases caused by human activity are the cause. The solutions are more complicated, and also on a more regional scale, it's not a unidirectional event. Populations of some organisms will be increasing in some parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
There will be more snow in some parts of some mountains than there is in others. So you can see, even now, looking at data, you can pick and choose data, if you would like, to argue different ways. If you look at all the data, it's hard, but if you try to do that kind of synthesis, mm-hmm. and that's what there's an international committee on climate change, which has tried to do this. They tried to look at all the data from many points of view, and then the trends are much more convincing mm-hmm. and clear cut. So this is, as we've been saying, it's a complicated problem, but it has some converging, really strongly converging conclusions now. So I think debate is important. We can never not have debate because we.
Well, it seems like we're going to have to make policy now, in the face of quite a bit of uncertainty. I mean, you may be certain about certain things, but in terms of the impacts or exactly how certain interactions work, policymakers are, you know, they're on the plate. It's their time to do something, and all the answers aren't quite in. So how is a policymaker going to deal with some of those vagaries?
Policymakers do that now, and that's what they're basically best at, making mm-hmm. decisions and facing uncertainty. And so I think in this case, it's one more example of that, and what we should try to do as scientists is to give them the best available information that we can and explain where there is uncertainty, and then decision makers are, I think, well attuned to do that. But I'd argue they shouldn't hide behind uncertainty, though, mm-hmm. because, in fact, that's what they do. The world is never certain.
Right.
Frank?
Yeah, I think just two observations. One, the media seems to always need to find somebody with the opposite opinion. So even if 999 people are pretty well persuaded by the evidence that climate is changing, if there's one out of 1,000 that's still out there saying it isn't, that's the other side of the view you'll hear.
That's how journalistic balance works,
yeah,
isn't
and
it?
It's not really healthy in terms of informing the public of the risks associated with climate mm-hmm. change. So that's my second point, is, as John said, there's still a lot of uncertainty in how climate change will play out, the magnitude, the severity, the location of different kinds of disruptions and mm-hmm. so forth. There's a lot of uncertainty. So you place yourself in the position of a risk analyst. And I think smart politicians look at what's at stake. You know, under even some scenarios of moderate climate change, what could it do to their state or to their country or to their town? I mean, that's why I think you look at somebody like Schwarzenegger and what he's done in California. You know, the AB 32, which is trying to reset our emissions back to 1990 levels of CO2 emissions, was a fairly bold stroke. But mm-hmm. he also looked at what's at risk in California. There are some other political reasons he did what he did. But it's certainly true. We're vulnerable to rapid climate change. For a lot of reasons.
Well, and that's a good place to end it because we're out of time, and I'd like to thank you guys for coming and thank people for watching, and we'll see you again on UCTV.